Lamassu. We return today to the meditative cultivation of compassion. And ordinarily, that is in the normal course of life without any specific spiritual practice or meditative development of compassion, many people experience it. I think probably most people experience compassion on occasion, and it tends to be episodic. Episodic, that is, some natural cataclysm arises, or during the CBTT, the tragedy in Norway arose. So something arises, very strong compassion arises in response to that, and then the episode becomes yesterday and a week ago and 2 weeks ago. It kind of fades off, and so the compassion tends to fade off right with it. So some adversity, some suffering arises, compassion arises to it, and then it fades out. So it tends to kind of come and go. And it doesn't really need much wisdom, perhaps no wisdom at all, to feel such compassion, and it can be genuine. But it's really attending to that most superficial, or most, not, and by superficial I don't mean trivial. By superficial I mean evident, easily, knowable dimension of suffering, namely the suffering of suffering or blatant suffering. But today I'd like to go a bit deeper to a dimension of suffering that, generally speaking, in the world is not regarded as suffering at all. And that's because it doesn't really feel that bad. It's not blatant suffering. Right? So it's called in classic Buddhist treatises the suffering of change. And to really attend to this so that it moves the heart, there must be some wisdom. There must be some insight. You can't just look at surface appearances. Right? You need to look beneath. You need to look more deeply. And so two aspects of reality are really crucial here. And one of these, and neither one of these, by the way, is just an article of faith, some belief that because the Buddha said so, or some other great Buddhist adept said so, it must be true, and therefore we all start bowing. But rather statements about our own experience that lend themselves to experiential investigation so we can see for ourselves whether they are true or false. And here's the first one. So I think the most interesting approach to this is to address this as a hypothesis to be put to the test with experience. Right? And the hypothesis is that all composite phenomena, everything that comes together independent upon causes and conditions, holes coming together out of parts, but the essential issue of everything arising in a causal nexus, everything that is composite or causally conditioned, is by nature impermanent, and impermanent meaning that it is constantly a state of flux. On the subtle level, there's nothing static among all these caused phenomena or composite phenomena. There's nothing static that carries on just as it was the same from day to day to day. But always in a constant state of flux. And the great majority of these composite phenomena, or things arising independent upon causing conditions, are there for a while, and then they aren't there any longer. So there was a point at which they, prior to which they weren't. So, for example, Tracy, I'm sure you're not 40 years old. So 40 years ago, you're not 40. You're more than 40. Oh, yeah. Okay. Leave it to me to try to guess a woman's age. I'm terrible. Okay, I'm sure you're not 50 years old. There we go. I thought I was safe, and I'm going to be really, you're not 90. So, but 50 years ago, Tracy was nowhere to be found, right? Anywhere on the planet or any other galaxy. And then at some point, and I'm not asking the age, I'm not that stupid, sometime between 50 years ago and now, some phenomenon new came into existence, independent upon quite a variety of causes and conditions. And her parents called her, I presume, or they probably didn't call you Tracy. But at some point, you know, this person came into existence, this particular individual. But prior to that point, this person wasn't there. And at some point, 50 years from now, no, could still be there, but at least 100 years from now, very unlikely. And so there are bookends to there. That's safe, isn't it? That's not pessimistic. And so there are bookends. And so that for the vast majority, not every single thing, but for the vast majority of phenomena that arise independent upon causing conditions, they weren't there, they're there, and they're no longer there. That not only is relevant to like people and things and places and so forth, but also relationships, like a marital relationship. That wasn't always there, it's there for a while, then it's no longer there. It terminates because one dies, the other dies, or there's divorce, or what have you. But There it is. So all phenomena then are impermanent. Nothing is static. Nothing is just immutable. And by and large, when we look at coarse impermanence, things arise, they decay, and then they disappear. They shed the identity of this person, for example, this person, this human being, no longer is there. No longer is there. So there's one point. Is that true or not? Well, we can attend closely to all types of phenomena, the natural environment, other people, our own minds, our own bodies, to see if there's anything here that is static, that is moving immutably through time. And the second point, one could say hypothesis, which is really a fascinating one for anybody who is interested in finding happiness and being free of suffering, is that we ever so easily mistake things that are not true sources of happiness, that are not actually wellsprings of happiness, to be wellsprings of happiness. So we get an idealized notion. Oh, if only I had a degree from Harvard. If only I had such and such an object of possession. If only I had a relationship with such and such a person. If only I could look in such and such a way. So some people spend a lot of time working out because they have some idea. If my biceps were bigger and my tummy were smaller and I didn't have these bags under my eyes, I'd be so much happier. You know? And so trying to craft that, make it so when I look into the mirror, oh, you make me happy. You good-looking guy, you. Of course, for me, that's just hopeless. I'm not falling into that one. And so this notion of looking to objects, whether appearances to the mind, other people, situations, jobs, intangibles like reputation, like status, like acknowledgement and love, the respect, adoration of other people, and so forth. The Buddhist term here, the Buddhist hypothesis is that our experience of anything, whether it's of another person, intangibles like fame, objects, our own body, and so forth, that insofar as, let's use a gradient again, I think very useful, insofar as our experience of any object, person, appearance, is conditioned by, or even dominated by, a mental affliction, such as craving, such as hostility, insofar as that experience, it doesn't matter what the experience is, will be unsatisfying. I think that's the intelligent articulation of a cliche that is terribly misleading, and that is life is suffering. Okay? I don't think the Buddha ever said that. It's such a silly statement. Life is suffering. Compared to what? You know? That kind of, like, all a standalone, it just doesn't mean anything. Except for I'm having a really bad day. And there was an article in the Journal of American, what was it? Journal of American Association of Religion, I think. I used to belong to it a long time ago. And that the journal article was, should the Buddha have been on Prozac? You know, was he basically kind of the depressive sort? And he could have stayed home and enjoyed being a good dad and a good husband if he just, you know, had balanced his brain chemistry a little bit better. You know? And so there we are. The insights of the academic community sometimes are really quite mind-boggling. What will they think of next? And so, unsatisfying. And now there's a very interesting one. And that is, there may be something we may very much want, a relationship, an object, a status, an education, a job, a place to live, and so forth, all the kind of things we want. And the mental affliction of craving. And again, some intelligence here is really needed. Some wisdom is really needed. Because I've seen so often, too often, this mental affliction of craving then just equated with desire. As if the root of suffering is desire. Well, I'm a little bit thirsty. My throat a little bit dry. I desired some water. Should I not have done that? Was that kind of a big boo-boo? Did I just disgrace this Dharma throne? You know? By right in the midst of everybody going for a glass of water and like, shame on him, he'd know better, you know? Well, I'm sticking by my guns here. When I want water, I'm just going to drink water, since I know it was poured for me. So desire can be wholesome, it can be unwholesome, it can be neutral. The desire for a glass of water is neutral. It's not a source of suffering, right? Desire may be very wholesome, very benevolent, the desire to free others of suffering. The desires, all kinds of desires, many kinds of desires, are very, very meaningful, very beneficial. But the mental affliction, which I'll translate as craving, sometimes translated as attachment or greed or lust. Craving is one I would choose if I just chose one. Something very specific. This relates to compassion, and we'll get to the meditation pretty quickly here. But when this mental affliction of craving arises, it's always rooted in a delusion of reifying. And reifying means to isolate, to decontextualize, to glom onto whatever one is attending to as if it exists in and of itself. So I tend to Mark, if I were attached to Mark or had craving for Mark, I would decontextualize Mark from all of the causes and conditions that are giving rise to Mark arising from moment to moment, right? I just conceptually carve him out of the whole situation and then have some attachment to a person, right? And that person existing from his own side. And now there's a reification and the craving, so reification being a type of delusion, the craving comes in. If I attend to Mark, or it could be an iPhone, whatever, and think, this is a true source of happiness for me. This man will make me happy. Or this great stage three, or whatever they call it, iPhone, you know, I've been happy ever since I got it. You know, that kind of notion, I wish. And so, latching onto again, people place all these kind of things as this is it. I've actually found it. I've isolated. And this is where my happiness comes from. You know, it comes up in a lot of very silly rock and roll songs, you know. You are, what do they say? I mean, all this gibberish. I mean, it kind of blends into one big mush of gobbledygook. But I can't live without you and all that kind of stuff. You can see I'm a real romantic at heart. But again, whether it's sexual, whether it's just greed for stuff and so forth, the notion that any appearance, any object is going to give rise as an actual source of well-being is a very interesting question. And when we ask about source, what is a true source of happiness? What will truly make you happy? Well, a source, to my mind, is, let's take a really good example, an artesian well. So out in the desert, I spent a lot of time in the desert. Out in the desert, you'll have the sand, and then you'll have, at some points, water just flowing right out of the soil. Or one retreat place I've gone up in the eastern Sierras, right out of the rocks, this crystal clear, marvelous, fresh spring water, coming all granite filtered and so forth. You just drink it right then, just the best water. And that is a true source of water. That is, whenever you go to that artesian well, that little opening in the earth, whenever you go there, and it's always producing water. And you come back, and there's more water. And if you just stay there and keep drink, it just keeps on producing water all the time. It's a real source of water. I'm not saying it's an ultimate source, but that's a real source of water. Whenever you go there, you get water. As long as you stay there, it gives you water. That's just water. It really is a source of water. And now, what we can ask in that same vein, what is a true source of happiness? Such that whenever you go to that source, you get happiness. For as long as you stay there, you keep on getting happiness. You stay there for a month, you just get an ongoing flow of happiness. Chocolate cake? No, she's brought that one down. Chocolate cake. You know. So this is where the misapprehension of reality comes in. And putting these two together, the reality of change, the reality of impermanence, and the reality of all experiences that are tainted by, let's just say this, tainted by craving, are unsatisfying. And that's, instead of saying are suffering, because that doesn't make any sense, are unsatisfying. They don't deliver, they're not true sources of happiness. So, this dimension of suffering, this suffering of change, as the first dimension, this blatant suffering, is quite closely related to ethics and non-ethical behavior, behavior that gives rise to misery. And also to anger, because when we experience anger, at least in my experience, it never feels good. It's always coming from because I'm dissatisfied or unhappy about something. I never feel so happy that I think, gosh, I'm just bubbling over with joy. I think I'm going to be angry now. You know, it doesn't happen. First, there has to be some dissatisfaction. And then the anger comes out of that. That's blatant. But when craving comes in, it can feel quite good. I'm gonna get happiness. I'm gonna get it. All I need is that. You're already in anticipation. Oh, that's gonna make me happy. That's gonna make me happy. And so it feels good. But fundamentally, it's going to be unsatisfying. So those two, the impermanence and the reality of what is truly satisfying, what is not satisfying. And relating these now to the second of the higher trainings, and that is the training in samadhi, the training in mental balance, which is very much includes shamatha. It includes the four immeasurables, so that's where this retreat is really located, in the higher training of samadhi. We're not dealing explicitly so much with the higher training in wisdom. Through that training in samadhi, and if we just kind of focus for the time being just on shamatha itself, which is, you know, kind of like a really good paradigm or excellent example of training in samadhi. As you balance the mind through the kind of training we're doing right here, there arises, without there being some stimulation, there arises a sense of ease. And that sense of ease, that sense of soothing, that sense of calm, of quiet, it feels good. And those people who have practiced shamatha a lot, become somewhat adept at it, find that it doesn't wear out. I mean, you can practice for 12 hours a day, and it's good for 12 hours a day. Even without achieving shamatha, just when you kind of get into the flow of it, it doesn't wear out. It's not like eating ice cream or driving a fast car or riding a motorcycle. I used to ride a really nice motorcycle, but 12 hours on the motorcycle is just exhausting. 12 hours on anything pretty much is exhausting, except for meditation. That's one of those things. Quite interesting. So the sense of ease, a sense of relaxation, and then out of that, this inner quiet, the composure, that doesn't get stale. A real sense of peace. Out of that coming the vividness, that doesn't get stale. And then as you proceed along that path of shamatha, and your mind eventually does settle in its natural state, which means your ordinary mind, your more ordinary mind, conceptual mind, dualistic mind, dissolves into this more, how do you say, subtle underlying continuum of consciousness. Some call the subtle continuum of mental consciousness, some in the Dzogchen tradition, the substrate consciousness. Those, who knows how many thousands of yogis who've experienced this over the last couple of thousand years, here's a major discovery, and it's uniform, and it's replicated so many times. It's one of the best known contemplative truths there is. And that is, when your mind does dissolve and your senses implode and you slip into and you achieve shamatha, and Hindus have done it, Taoists in all likelihood have done it, the Buddhists of multiple schools have done it, that you find that there is an innate luminosity in the nature of your awareness itself, just a wakefulness, a brightness, a radiance of awareness itself. There is a blissfulness, a bliss that arises that is not stimulus-driven, because there's nothing appearing to you that's making you happy. What's appearing to you is the substrate, which is kind of like a whole lot of nothing. It's just a vacuous field, so that's kind of like an absence of stimulation. But your mind is so balanced that the bliss arises as a symptom of the mind being in balance. And then the non-conceptuality, the profound stillness, the serenity of a quiet mind that is luminously clear and quite blissful. Those are found to be the three salient qualities of the mind when it descends into, when it dissolves into, melts into its natural state. In Tibetan, desel mitopa, so easy to say. So bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. And the Buddha said of the bliss of samadhi is not to be feared. Not to be feared. There's a lot of emphasis on renunciation and overcoming craving and all of that. But when it comes to the bliss of samadhi, he said, oh, this one's not to be feared. Not to be feared. Right? So, as we attend to sentient beings, now we're bringing this over to compassion. As we bring this over to attending to sentient beings, and for so much of us, so many of us, for so much of the time, in our pursuit of happiness and our wish to be free of suffering, it's driven by craving. It's driven by having some kind of an idealized notion, some reification, some superpositions of this will make me happy. And then craving for it, lunging for it, going for it. And then if we get it, then trying to hold on tight, make sure that it doesn't change, secure it, keep it safe. Holding on, holding on. And in the midst of all of that, from the Buddhist perspective, I would say, and of course I think it's just true, there's something unsatisfying from start to finish. When you've not yet found it, when you're craving something but you've not yet found it, there's an uneasiness, there's anxiety, there's kind of a lack of rest, that maybe I won't get it, maybe I won't get it, I hope I do, but maybe I won't. And so it's unsatisfying. We haven't got it yet, so it's unsatisfying. And then you do get it, but now you got to hold on to it. And you may lose it at any time. And so once again, unsatisfying. And does it change? Did you wanted something that probably was relatively static in your mind, and now that you've got it, you're probably going to find that it's impermanent, that it's not as static, as idealized, as nice and perfect as you thought. It's changing, changing, maybe slipping right through your fingers. Unsatisfying in the beginning, unsatisfying in the middle, and unsatisfying in the end, in the sense that, and I'll quote once again Goenka, I often quote him on this one point, you remember it, that is when you're grasping onto something with craving and attachment. There's only two possible outcomes. You're holding on to it. Oh, this makes me so happy. This makes me so happy. And it disappears. Or you grasp onto it. Oh, this is my happiness. This is what really makes me happy. And you disappear. And there's no third option. That's it. So a life based on craving is like a Greek tragedy. It's just waiting for the bad end, you know? Because it's always going to be a bad end, you know? Because either it disappears or you disappear, and then that gives rise to, oh, bummer. So, as we try to bring this home, back to our own lives, it's a matter of overcoming delusion-based craving. So we just drop this revocation and idealization of objects, appearances, people, and so forth as being true sources of happiness. Overcoming that, overcoming the single point of fixation on hedonic well-being, and start to prioritize more and more the cultivation rather than the hunting and foraging for things out there that will make us happy, shifting over to the more the cultivator phase of cultivating states of awareness, qualities of awareness, or discovering dimensions of awareness that are true sources of well-being. So shamatha is one of those. To achieve shamatha is tapping into an artesian well of relative happiness. But it doesn't get stale. So many people have achieved it. And once you've achieved it, you can slip back into it quite effortlessly. And as long as you're in, it's just an artesian well. You just feel good all the way through. That's why it can be very seductive. Why it can be really a trap. And why you should have a bigger framework and a larger aspiration than just achieving shamatha, because you can get there and then just get stuck. Like just, you know, elevated dopamine levels or something. I don't know. So, recognizing where true sources of happiness lie, recognizing where they don't lie, and shifting one's aspiration, shifting one's priorities to seeking a path of ever deepening, ever increasing genuine happiness, and then, how do you say, releasing one's attachment to the hedonic pleasures. When this kind of shift of priorities, the shift of motivations, occurs within oneself, then that's called renunciation. Renunciation. Or the Tibetan would suggest more kind of a spirit of emergence. Korwa le nge parajungena ngenjung. That is, one has this sense of emergence because one is emerging from samsara, emerging from the fixation on and the, how do you say, the total prioritization of hedonic pleasures, and shifting over, emerging towards a vision of genuine happiness, a path to liberation, a path of awakening, in which case that's really a revolution. I've spoken often of revolutions, the Galilean or Copernican revolution, the Darwinian revolution, the revolution in modern physics, 20th century physics, where wherever the revolution is taking place, you can no longer view that reality in the same way. Human existence, human species, you can't view humanity in the same way once you've understood the insights of Darwin, right? And likewise for Copernicus, likewise for quantum mechanics and relativity, you cannot view space, time, matter, or energy in a 19th century fashion any longer if you've understood 20th century physics. Because you just know that's just not true, and it's never been true. Space has never been absolute, time not absolute, energy, momentum, velocity, and mass, none of them are absolute. And they never were. They were just assumed to be, but that was just a big delusion that saturated, you know, centuries of people who thought about the physical universe. And so there's a revolution here as well. It's a fundamentally a radical shift in the way you view reality. Rather than thinking, all I need to do is look carefully enough and be lucky or be smart enough or be diligent enough, and I will find the person who will make me happy. And the job and the perfect car and the excellent house and the fine physique, and I'll surround myself by a whole bunch of great friends. They'll make me happy. And I just have to be clever enough. And then I'll get it. You know? And then the term is sunjimba, radical disillusionment. Radical disillusionment. And that is thinking, you know, after 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, saying, this has never worked. Now, a person just springs to mind. I will keep him anonymous. This person, very successful in business, very smart, very hardworking, but also very bright, really knows how to make money, and made a lot of it, gobs of it. And then got to the age of about 50, 55. And the way this guy could spend money was pretty impressive. I don't know how many millions of dollars on an enormous yacht, and this and that, and like, whoa. You know. And then finding that, you know, pretty much anything he wanted, he could buy, and he kind of did. Then finding none of this is making me happy. All that hard work for 20, 30 years, and now I succeeded perhaps beyond my wildest dreams, and anything I want, really, I can now buy. And it's all empty. It's not giving me happiness. Not giving me happiness. I spoke with him some time ago. I want to leave this rather vague. If you guessed who it was, if you guessed who I'm thinking of, it wouldn't be a disaster. But I think just keep it general. But I was speaking with him, and I just commented to him from my side that hedonic pleasures just don't do it for me much. That is, if something hedonic arises, it might spark the interest, a little spike of interest. But for me, from my own experience, it has no staying power, you know? It's like, oh, that's novel. Oh, now it's no longer novel. Okay, that's novel. That's just water. That's not novel. But the iPhone 5 is coming out in the fall. And I'm heard that's got two cameras, the one in the front and the one in the back, and you can Skype, and that would make you happy, wouldn't it? Be able to Skype with somebody on an iPhone? Man, if that doesn't make you happy, I don't know what would make you happy. And I don't know, but they're like little miracle machines. The next one is just going to be so breathtaking. That might be the last one. You know, see, we did 5. It's just perfection, you know? And from then on, it'd just be rotten apples, so why not just, you know, stick with 5? So, disillusionment. A radical disillusionment. And that's what happened to this person. And there was a point where he said, if I continued, I would have died. Because he was so good at what he did, so good at making money. He was just so smart, had such good intuition for making money. In the meantime, his body was just falling apart. And he said, if I continued for another year or two, I probably would be dead. But he recognized this is giving nothing. He'd succeeded. He's a good-looking man, and industrious, and he's charming, and he's intelligent, and he had everything. And it gave him nothing. So at that point, you can become totally disillusioned and then just fall into despair or try to maintain yourself like a French existentialist and say, just keep a stiff upper lip. Or is that the British? I think the British keep their stiff upper lip. What do the French do? They just say grin and bear it or don't commit suicide, you know? I don't know. But it's possible to be totally disillusioned with samsara, totally disillusioned with the pursuit of hedonic pleasure, and not have any alternative. And my impression is that's where Camus and Sartre got. Really deep insight into the vacuity, the emptiness of what we would call samsara. But then, now that you're disillusioned with that, now where do you go? And like, nada. There's no other direction. That's it. So life is just futile. Life is empty, devoid of meaning. But let's just be brave and bear it. And that's one half of renunciation. You know what you're disillusioned with, but you have no direction to go. And that's not Buddhist renunciation. That's why I don't really like the word renunciation so much, because it's all negative. You're renouncing this, but it doesn't tell you where you go, right? And so that's not such a good translation. This nianjung, this definite emergence, implies you're emerging from and you're emerging to. You're emerging from samsara and you're emerging towards a path of liberation and awakening. So I think it's time to sum up. I've been rambling on for about a half an hour here. To apply this to oneself, to recognize again, to draw on one's own memory of the ways that one has sought people, objects, places, and so forth in the pursuit of happiness, and then found out it was unsatisfying. It did not fulfill. It was not a true source of happiness. Recognizing that for oneself, being disillusioned, disillusioned, having a type of revolution. That's what happened to this man. It was just hedonic. It was like 100% hedonic. And then he had the magnificent good fortune to succeed totally and see how totally empty it was. Where so many people don't succeed that much, and they, oh, if I'd just been as lucky as that guy, then I'd be as happy as he is. And he has no happiness at all, but I don't know that, because he's looking good. He's looking really good. And you see his car. Anybody drives a car like that's got to be happy. Let alone his yacht. 160-foot yacht. I think it was a three-master. That he would just have sailing around the world continuously with a full crew. And he'd just fly into a port and sail with him for a little while and then fly off. And it just kept on going around the world. You know? And I asked him, what was that like? You know, to fly to Johannesburg and hop in your yacht and go to Mumbai. He said, it's boring. Once you've done it, you've sailed from Johannesburg to Mumbai. Now, what's it going to be like if you sail from Mumbai to Colombo? Well, it's still ocean, you know. Kind of, it's blue sky. And then from Mumbai to Phuket, well, it was blue. There's a lot of water. You know, it bored him to death really quickly, and it was a magnificent boat. It was a really fantastic boat, beautiful thing. But when he was actually on it and say, now I am the owner. Oh. So, happily this person then found something, a path that is meaningful, that gives rise to genuine happiness. So for all of those, and now really, let's bring this back to compassion. For oneself to reflect upon this way, to arouse the yearning, may I be free of the suffering of change, and that suffering of change comes most explicitly from the mental affliction of craving. Rooted in delusion. May I be free of that suffering of change and the underlying cause, and that is craving. Above all, it's craving. And to see this is not just an aphorism and not just a belief system. This is real suffering, and that's a real cause of suffering, and may I be free, imagining that, that's renunciation or the spirit of emergence. And then as soon as one turns one's awareness outwards to other people and sees the single-mindedness with which we so often are focusing on things that have never been and never will be true sources of happiness, and yet focusing on them as if they were, and kind of like, and then getting them, perhaps, if we're fortunate, getting them, and then figuring, now I've got to hold on. That this is not episodic. I come back to the earlier point. The compassion arising in response to blatant suffering is episodic. Blatant suffering goes away, the compassion goes away. But this suffering of change, that can go on for years, that can go on for decades, lifetimes, right? A single-minded pursuit, and yet it's all like a Greek tragedy. It just can, you look, as soon as it starts, you see a person setting off on a trajectory with craving and attachment. Oh, Stanford degree. Oh, if I could only get a job at Google. Only if I could have a Jaguar. How did that work out? What it, you know, whatever it is. And as soon as you see it, you can just start practicing compassion immediately. Because however it's going to turn out, it's rooted in delusion, it's driven by craving, it's been dissatisfying. And so that level of compassion is deeper. It's deeper. I'll end with an anecdote. 1992, I was with a group of scientists, really turned out to be, well, they were very good scientists back then. They are quite renowned by now. Richard Davidson, Francisco Varela, Clifford Seren, who's become the eminent principal investigator for the Shamatha Project, Craig Simpson, I think there was another one, I think that's pretty much it. Very fine neuroscientist. And I was with him as kind of an interpreter and cultural liaison, and with His Holiness' blessing, we hiked up the mountains above Dharamsala, where these yogis, meditating for decades up there. And there was one who was relatively young, he'd only been there for a short time, kind of like us, he was kind of like really new to meditation. He'd only been in retreat for 6 years. Kind of like us. He was quite young, too. I think he's like 35, 40 years old. Youngster. And so these scientists came into his room. He invited. This was all with permission. And they asked him, we'd like to study compassion from the outside, behavioral expressions, things like that. And so do we have your permission to show you some video clips? And then we would like to monitor your response to the video clip. And so it was informed consent. And I think they gave, I can't remember the exact what they said, but they gave him some idea what these video clips would be. Now this is 1992. Just 5 years earlier, I'm quite sure it was 1987, there were those demonstrations of especially Tibetan monks in Lhasa. And the crackdown by the Chinese Communist government was very, very brutal. And so someone had managed to do a videotape of some monk that was surrounded by military, and they were beating him with batons, beating him and kicking him. And he was down and just cowering, and they were kicking him and beating him. And video went on, just showing this monk just being beaten, savagely beaten. And somehow they got the video out of Tibet. And so the scientists had this video. And so in this little meditation hut, way up in the mountains, an hour and a half hike up above the nearest town, McLeod Gunge, set up the little video screen and put in the video, and they had the monk sitting right in front of the video screen, and then there was another video camera focusing on his face to see what would be his facial expressions, drawing on Paul Ekman's work and all of that. And so how would he respond? This monk, this Tibetan monk, seeing some of his fellow Tibetan monks, I think there might have been even more than one, being really brutally beaten. And so all the scientists sitting around watching, the video camera on, they turned on the video. And I'd seen it many times. And there it is, so we're all watching. And the monk just, he gazed right at it. And his expression throughout the whole video was pretty much like this. There's no facial expression at all. It's just neutral. And they ran the whole video. And the scientist was really quite perplexed. Like, is this one of the bad apples? You know, contemplative rejects, you know? Put him in the slow starter category or something? And so he just didn't show any response at all. And so the scientists then, when the video had been shown, they came to him and asked, we didn't see anything, you know, in terms of a response. I mean, that was really awful. And what were you feeling when you saw these monks being beaten like that? Did you feel sadness? Did you feel compassion? Did you feel indifference? What did you feel? And the monk's response was, I wasn't watching monks being beaten. I was watching a video. Those are flickering images on the screen. That's what I was watching. And so no, I didn't feel anything special as I'm watching that. I'm watching flickering image of the screen of images of monks being beaten. And then the conversation continued. Yeah, but you know that was a documentary. That really happened. And he said, I know that all the time. I know that all the time. There's always suffering in the world. That's one episode. But at all times, this is an ocean of suffering. Sentient beings around the world. There's always suffering. So why, seeing a video, would you think that that's going to somehow jack up some special emotion? I'm always aware of this. So he was more just like living in a world of compassion rather than waiting for something unpleasant or sad to occur and then springing up and feeling, oh, may they be free. That was just one episode, but the ocean of suffering, it was just part of his overall worldview. And why he was there, I think this is not an exaggeration. Why was he in his retreat? Why was he devoting himself day and night to Dharma practice to try to transform his mind so that he can be of greater service to alleviate the suffering of the world? It was quite an eye-opener for the scientists. So, let's go to the practice. We'll direct it inwardly, first of all, to arouse the spirit of emergence, directing outwards, arousing compassion. It's all of a continuum. They're not really radically different. then the same spirit of compassion for ourselves, the same aspiration to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Let's settle the body in its natural state, the respiration in its natural rhythm. And cultivate a sense of inner peace, of serenity, of inner calm. By settling your mind in its natural state, at ease, still, and clear. For a little while, calm the discursive mind by way of mindfulness of breathing, just for a short time. Now arouse the clarity of your awareness, drawing on memory, drawing on your own experience, attending especially to those occasions when you have been driven by craving, by the pursuit, the fixation on hedonic pleasure. As you bring such occasions to mind, pose the question, was there anything truly satisfying there? Did you at any time tap into a true wellspring, a true source of happiness, of genuine satisfaction? Or did it always leave you thirsting for more, and the pursuit of one more vision, one more object that you think would bring you happiness? as you envision the possibility of genuine happiness, tapping into a true wellspring of happiness, of meaning, of satisfaction, with each in-breath arouse the yearning, may I be free of this suffering of change, this ocean of dissatisfaction. And its underlying causes. Recognizing that the true cause of dissatisfaction is the craving itself, not some inadequacy on the part of the object. And arouse the yearning, may I be free. Imagine being free. Imagine being clear-headed regarding the actual causes of happiness and the true sources of suffering. Imagine the freedom from anxiety. As you turn your attention inwards, where you really can bring about very meaningful change, deep and lasting change. Turn your attention to others. It may be a person you know well. Whose well-being is based upon craving, the attachment to things that have required. Starting in dissatisfaction, continuing in dissatisfaction, and ending in dissatisfaction. With each in-breath arouse the yearning, may you, like myself, be free of the suffering of change and the underlying causes. Bring to mind those whose lives are dominated by the attachment, the craving for wealth, for sensual pleasures, for fame. For the praise and appreciation of others. Where there's dissatisfaction if their aspirations are not realized, and then sooner or later dissatisfaction if their desires are realized. Imagine freedom as you let your attention rove from individuals you know, individuals you simply know of, to whole communities. Attending to the suffering that people experience as their lives are dominated, driven by delusion-based craving, and arouse the yearning, and may you be free. And imagine their freedom. What would it be like to pursue happiness and the freedom from suffering in a way that is reality-based, focusing on the true sources of happiness, identifying the true sources of unhappiness, cultivating one while dispelling the other. And imagine their freedom. you attend to all beings, everyone who comes to mind. Imagine each one seeing with clarity. What are the true causes of happiness? The true causes of suffering? And turning their attention to the cultivation of their own hearts and minds, where there's really a chance of finding satisfaction. The only chance. But there's promise. A true revolution in the pursuit of happiness. as we've done before, release all appearances, all objects of the mind, and release all aspirations. And with an utter sense of ease and release, let your awareness come to rest in its own nature, illuminating and knowing itself. Fire away, Kate. The microphone is coming. not just yet, unless you want to say something off camera. The microphone is coming. Yeah. We want to record your words for posterity. Diego, any timeline about when it's going to get uploaded? Oh, that'd be good. Thank you. That gives me hope. Kay, what's up?
You know what's up. Acquired sign.
Acquired sign.
Yes. Would you say something about, I think it's chapter 3.
Uh-huh.
Shamatha with an acquired sign.
Yeah.
You said you would discuss it?
Happy to, sure. This is a bit down the road in the meditative cultivation of, mindfulness of breathing. And as a very brief preamble, mindfulness of breathing can be used in two different ways, qualitatively different. Mindfulness of breathing can be used as a means for achieving shamatha. Mindfulness of breathing can be used for the cultivation of insight as a vipassana practice. It has a different ambience, a different kind of style to it. As a shamatha practice, now I'm going back to Buddhaghosa, and I do rely heavily on him, I think for some very good reasons. This is 5th century, so roughly 1,500 years ago. He was not known as a great innovator. Other people like Tsongkhapa, like Sakyapandita and so forth, Nagarjuna, Asanga and so forth, they were brilliant minds who really made some great breakthroughs, freshly illuminated in unprecedented ways, some aspects of the Buddhist teachings. Buddhaghosa, not so much. That was not his aspiration, that is not his skill, but rather he was a tremendous synthesizer. So he drew from, number one, encyclopedic knowledge of the Buddha's own teachings in the Pali Canon, of course, and then commentaries up to his time. But he drew on so many sources and he synthesized this all into, for example, his text Visuddhimagga, laying out the path of purification and commentaries to many of the Buddha's teachings. But drawing on the experience and the insights of centuries of contemplatives preceding him. So he was a synthesizer, kind of rounding up, bundling up, putting it all into a coherent package. So when I citing Buddhaghosa, I'm not citing one unique special yogi who said, oh, these are my insights. But I don't know if anybody really knows what his insights were. I mean, how deep his own meditative experience was. I don't even see it coming up much, because that's not what it was about, but rather synthesizing generations of very deep insight. So drawing on him, he lays out with extraordinary clarity this practice of mindfulness of breathing, and it starts with the tip of the nostrils. focusing on the rise and fall of the abdomen, I think this is really, in the Theravada tradition, probably 20th century vintage. It could be as recent as simply Mahasi Sayadaw himself. That doesn't mean that since it's new, it's not good. It means that it's new, that it's a fairly recent introduction, at least in the Theravada tradition. But the classic tradition in Theravada is to focus on the tactile sensations of the breath at the nostrils. And that we've kind of built up to with this, you know, this 21st century emphasis, hey, mellow out first, because it's so easy to skip that. And if we skip it, then it's going to be a problem for the rest of our meditative experience. And so many unnecessary problems can arise. So that's why I've spoken with quite a few of you by now. If you spend this whole first week just learning how to relax, that's time well spent, right? So you set that kind of, that ambience. So sooner or later you come up to the sensations of the breath at the apertures of the nostrils, and those sensations are called the preliminary sign. Preliminary sign. So you're focusing on something sensory, right? And I won't elaborate on that, but that's so preliminary sign. Now, if one does this, again, let's say 8 hours a day for 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, something like that, and there's no regularity about exactly when this so-called acquired sign is going to take place, but an acquired sign is a mental image, and it's one that arises spontaneously. It's not something that you visualize, right? It just happens all by itself. And so as you develop in this practice, you're developing along stage one, stage two, stage three, along there, maybe stage four. You're developing that real unification of the mind. Get to stage four, you're no longer even falling off the object entirely. Somewhere along that continuum, and it differs from one person to the next. Some people might have the acquired sign arise in stage two or three. Other ones can get to stage five or six and still not have it arise. Okay, and that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It's just different people, different strokes for different folks. It happens differently for different people. But sooner or later, especially when you're having really relatively quite a good session, and your attention is getting quite focused, calm, relaxed, quite unified, and you're attending now to probably very subtle sensations, because the whole respiration is getting subtler and subtler. You just don't need so much oxygen. But as you're attending to this, rather single-pointedly, right there in that general field of your attention, so here you are in front of your face, but now in the mental space, so it's not tactile, it's not visual, it's not something you see with the eyes, in the mental space, right where you were focusing, spontaneously, there will arise an image, a mental image. And Buddhaghosa, he's the primary authority here, so I'm just simply citing him in the Attention Revolution. He said, oh, it's a variety. There's not just one image. It could be like a garland. It could be like a moon. It could be like a piece of gauze, like a white piece of gauze, you know, like that. It could be like simply a single star. It could be like a little garland, like a little necklace. Be a variety. There are images of light. They could be of different colors, but they just arise spontaneously, like that. Now, as you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, all kinds of things can rise to mind at any time. All kinds of stuff, and so you get a little necklace coming up to mind. Maybe you're thinking about your wife's birthday. You know, that doesn't mean it's an acquired sign, or you know, again, all kinds of images coming and going. So they come and go, but when the acquired sign comes, there are a couple of really salient characteristics, and that is the acquired sign tends to appear when you are really relatively very focused, not when your mind is scattered and all kinds of stuff is coming up. So it's when the mind has really gotten very quiet, not much intrusion by images and so forth, and then one comes in, and it's coming in right where you were attending, and you might, when you first see it, say, well, that's a distraction, I'm not interested, and you come right back to the sensations of the breath. But this is going to be persistent if it's the acquired sign. Whenever you're having one of those sessions that are really quite coherent, quite grounded, focused, sustained, that's when it tends to come in. And almost the defining characteristic of this acquired sign is that it keeps on coming back, and it comes back in pretty much the same form, and it comes back on those occasions. So it comes back 10 times, 20 times, 30 times, you know, from day to day, and it keeps like knocking on the door. So when that happens, when you can see it, it's kind of crystallized, it's formed into a uniform type of image. And it's spontaneous, so you don't try to jumpstart it, you don't try to get it to go quickly. Well, I think mine should be a moon, and oh, there's a moon, you know. Then you're just doing, you know, then you're practicing shamatha on an image of a moon. Nothing wrong with that, right? I studied with one Mongolian geshe a long time ago, 1975 or 6, in Switzerland. I was interested in shamatha back then. See, I got a fixated mind. And I asked him, you know, what would you suggest as a meditative object for shamatha? And he said, well, what I'd really recommend is focus on a really familiar object, something really familiar to you that's easy to bring to mind. He said, for example, your teacher, Geshe Rabten. He's got a big nose. Why don't you focus on Geshe Rabten's nose? So you could achieve shamatha focusing on it, you know, generating image of the moon, and you could do that. Or your teacher's nose. You could do that. But this acquired sign is not something deliberately generated. It comes up spontaneously. So when it happens in that way, it comes when you're really focused, the mind is quiet, it comes persistently. Then when it's kind of knocked on your door a number of times where you feel, this is probably the acquired sign. Then, like a rocket, the old-fashioned rockets where the lower stage where it's burnt out of fuel just falls away and then something else takes off, like a second stage, you disengage your attention from the tactile sensations. And now you're focusing entirely on the acquired sign, which is purely a mental image, a mental image. And that becomes your object from then on. Now, if you lose it, you know, 2 days later you have some emotional upheaval and it doesn't arise, then you come back to the preliminary sign. But sooner or later, if the acquired sign has arisen, it's going to come back again, and then you connect with that again, leave the tactile sensations, focus on the mental, and that's it. You focus single-pointedly on that spontaneously arisen mental image called the acquired sign, right? Until you actually achieve shamatha, and again, speaking technically, this is access to the first jhana, so I won't try to explain that right now, but it's rarefied state of samadhi, by no means the highest, but a really good platform. When you achieve access to the first jhana, or achieve shamatha, then something quite unusual happens. And that by that time, no matter what your shamatha method, by the time you've achieved shamatha, your senses have imploded. The Theravada tradition says this, the Tibetan tradition says this. People know about shamatha, that's just the nature of it. That your senses have imploded, and your mind is totally focused with clarity, with great stability, in the mental domain. And so when you're really up there, like stage 9 or so, on the path of shamatha, and you're now focused single-pointedly, like your world consists of a space and that acquired sign within it. That's all that's left, right? Just single-pointedly focusing on that. Then you achieve shamatha. And when you achieve shamatha, what Buddhaghosa says, it's like this acquired sign, it's kind of like it breaks apart, and then another sign arises. And this other sign is called the counterpart sign. And Buddhaghosa said this is 100, nay, 1,000 times more subtle than the acquired sign. And the counterpart sign is actually emerging from another dimension of reality altogether, which is called the form realm, or rupa dhatu. It's not gross physical matter like we have here. It's a much subtler dimension. And that's the origin of it. It's coming from that dimension. And the counterpart sign that arises as a result of achieving shamatha by way of mindfulness of breathing is going to be closely associated with the air element as opposed to water, fire, earth. It's going to be, in the words of one really fine Sri Lankan Buddhist scholar, he said the counterpart sign is like the conceptual quintessence of the corresponding element. One can almost say like the archetype from the form realm, the archetype of air element. And that arises, but it's so subtle. It's so subtle, 100, nay, 1,000 times more subtle than the acquired sign, which was your vehicle, you know, to get there, that in all likelihood, when that a counterpart sign first arises, it'll kind of introduce itself to you, it'll arise, but it's so subtle that your mind will not be able to fully engage with it and sustain that attention. And so Buddhaghosa says here, it arises, you touch it, and then like a little toddler, like a two-year-old, that stands up on its wobbly little legs and then goes boop and falls back on his bum. Your attention rises up, engages with that counterpart sign, but it's so subtle, you just can't sustain it. And you go boop and you fall back into what in the Pali canon is called, or the Pali literature is called, bhavanga. And the bhavanga, I will say, experientially, it is the same as the substrate consciousness. But now that you've rested there, you've achieved shamatha. And the mind is clear, has no object, because you're no longer focusing on the acquired sign, but the preliminary sign arose, introduced itself, and then kind of slipped away again because you couldn't sustain it. Now you're just resting in the substrate consciousness, right? And so you've achieved shamatha. So now if you'd like to venture into vipassana or cultivating the four immeasurables or bodhicitta or anything else, you've got a mind extremely serviceable. But if you're not satisfied with achieving shamatha, you'd like to achieve the full stage, the full first jhana, the actual first jhana. Not just access to it, which is like on the threshold, but you want to kind of capture it, to master, fully master the first jhana, the first meditative stabilization. Then it's as if you achieve shamatha all over again. And that is, you wait there and you attend very closely until you retrieve that counterpart sign. And then you take that as your object. And you stabilize on that, which is far more subtle, again, than the acquired sign. And when you can stabilize on that, kind of master it, so you can hold it at will for as long as you like, oh, then that's the means for achieving the actual state of the first jhana. So in the Buddhaghosa, once again, he said, if you have fully achieved the first jhana, right, and that's not nearly as good as the second jhana or the third jhana or the fourth jhana or the absorptions up in the formless realm, just the first jhana. Oh, if you've achieved that, he said, you can enter into samadhi and you can remain in samadhi continuously for 24 hours at a stretch. No problem. He said, now this is like a strong man who can stand up on his two legs and remain standing for 24 hours at a stretch. So, that's if you achieve the actual state of the first jhana. In the Tibetan tradition, that's where most of my training is, of course, not much emphasis. I mean, academically they study this. I've studied it a long time ago. How, you know, these different jhanas and so forth. But experientially, Anil, have you ever heard, and Andrea, are you with us? Have you ever heard any Tibetan lamas really give practical instructions? Here's how you achieve the Samden Dambu Muji, the actual state of the first jhana. Me neither. These are two very knowledgeable people. I've been around for a while. Studied academically, it's in the Parchin literature, the Abhisamalankara literature, and you study it, all the details. But and I've received those teachings. They seem incredibly intellectual. Very abstract, very theoretical. Not to say that that nobody has achieved it, but when it comes to practice time in the Tibetan tradition, all kinds of practical manuals on achieving shamatha. All the traditions have it. Gagyu, Nyingma, Sakya, all of them have that. Really good manuals. Sometimes focusing on Buddha image, on the mind, whatever. But once they've achieved just shamatha, access to the first jhana, in the Tibetan tradition, they seem to be quite content with that. And if you've achieved access to the first jhana, then it's not as stable as the full achievement of the first jhana. You can't necessarily sit for 24 hours at a stretch, but you can sit for 4 hours at a stretch, effortlessly, in impeccable samadhi, minimum 4 hours. And that's good enough. That's good enough. Overall, in Tibetan view, how much samadhi is needed in order for your practice of vipassana to be fully effective? Access is sufficient. So that's why they speak of achieving shamatha. That's enough. If you really want to be a samadhi gung-ho guy person, then you can go off and do that, but maybe go to a Theravada country for that. You know. But if you're really on the track of really going right for vipassana, for bodhicitta, vajrayana, mahamudra, dzogchen, there's just kind of no emphasis at all that I've seen of going, in terms of straight samadhi practice, going beyond shamatha. Because they're so eager to get onto really much more meaningful things. And I'll end on this point. Dujom Lingba, with his master, well, his Stilling the Mind is my commentary on just the first section. I'm pretty sure it's in that first, I'm just about positive, in that first section. He says, if all you achieve is shamatha, so now your mind is dissolved into substrate consciousness, and you're simply enjoying the bliss, the luminosity, the non-conceptuality. And he says, oh, good, I got what I wanted. I got shamatha, and I'm just going to enjoy this. You know, just sit in meditation. After a while, you need to go to the bathroom, go to the toilet, have a sandwich. Good. Go to the bathroom and eat a sandwich. You know, and just kind of enjoy your shamatha. He said, you have not moved even one inch towards enlightenment. You're just treading water in the middle of the ocean of samsara. You find a nice place to tread water, but that's all it is. You're going nowhere. You're going nowhere at all. To get there is really to get someplace. To stay there is to be nowhere. It's quite interesting, a balance there. Oh, yeah. Oh, we have questions coming up now. Yes, Deborah. And I'll be less loquacious tomorrow so we can have more time for questions. Go ahead.
I have a question about the practice.
Oh, I love those.
I'm used to meditating with my eyes closed.
Right.
And so I'm finding it quite challenging to meditate with my eyes open. I find that when my eyes are closed, my mind is actually more vivid. And able to pay attention.
Yeah.
When I try to meditate with my eyes open, because I'm not used to it, I either feel sleepy or I develop...
Really? Sleepy? Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I know it's probably supposed to be the other way around, but I think it's habit. That because I'm used to meditating with them closed, I'm used to paying attention.
It is habit. It's very much a matter of habit.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. And so I'm wondering how important it is to keep your eyes open. Is it okay to, what I'm doing at the moment is trying with my eyes open for a while, and then when I get too sleepy, I close them, and then I wake up a bit.
Yeah. You're really bad.
Thought so.
Actually, it is integral. It is integral to the practice to keep the eyes open. And when we're not accustomed to it, some people start feeling the eyes starting to ache a little bit, the eyes start to water, they feel kind of weird, they start feeling blurry vision, and they just don't like it at all. And the answer to that is get over it, pretty much. Now, how to get over it? Because there are reasons for it. I'm looking at the time because there's a lot that can be said about this. I'm going to try to keep it short. And that is, as a strategy, these are great masters. These are Pinchen Losen Chukyi Gyantsen, it's Lerap Lingba, it's Dujum Lingba. So many of these great masters saying, keep the eyes open, keep it. And Padmasambhava in the book Natural Liberation, one of the treasures attributed to him, actually gives some subtle physiology why it's very important to have the eyes open. So it's not trivial, it's not just simply a tradition, but when it's creating the problems, you want to get through that. So here's one possibility. And that is on occasion, maybe if you're meditating early in the morning before it's light, or in the evening after it's dark, turn off all the lights in your room, and then meditate with your eyes open in a dark room. Then that's fine, because Padmasambhava never said turn on the lights, because they didn't have any lights. You know, turn on the sun. I mean, what are you going to turn on? You know, you can imagine the yogis in caves centuries into. But what are they going to turn on? They had no kerosene, they couldn't afford wax. You know, wax costs something. So what do? Your illumination to the sun and the moon. That's pretty much it. So let your eyes be open, but in a dark room. And then you'll probably find that dissolves the problem. Keep the eyes totally relaxed. Blink whenever you like. The ambience is, just imagine on a nice, warm, sunny Sunday afternoon. I say in terms of leisure and just kind of time to hang out. Imagine going out to a nice grassy field, lying on your back on a blanket, like a picnic, and then just staring up in the sky and having a daydream, just daydreaming. Going off into different places, you know. Tahiti, Detroit. Places you've always wanted to go. You know? But with your eyes open, your eyes probably won't start feeling weird because they're just totally relaxed. And you blink whenever you like. But you're not looking at anything. Your eyes are just open, but you're thinking about, you know, visiting the Ford automobile factory and getting a guided tour, your own guided tour. So something like that. Very briefly, why? Well, I won't go into the subtle physiology. That would take a little while. But I give two real quick reasons. One is totally, how do you say, a little bit deeper. And that is, this is to overcome, I would suggest, or at least I found this to be the case. I've never read this anywhere. To overcome the kind of assumption that's very prevalent in the modern world, the 20th, 21st century, that the mind is inside the head, that your emotions are here and your visual images are over here, and anxiety is in there, down in the amygdala, and your happiness is over here in the left prefrontal cortex, and, you know, and sounds are occurring over here in the auditory cortex. I mean, this is superstition. Nobody's ever seen a mental image inside the brain. They've gone through the whole brain, top to bottom. And they find a whole bunch of chemicals and electricity, but they don't find any images. They don't find any emotions. So that's really just a fabulous myth that the mind is actually inside the brain. There's no evidence for it at all. Actually, zero. And yet it saturates the media that your thoughts are here and emotions are here and images are here and blah, 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 blah. It's amazing how that goes unchallenged for so long. And it's just sloppy thinking because what is there are the neural correlates of these subjective experiences. But that doesn't mean the subjective experiences are in there. Now, when we close our eyes, especially as modern people living in this materialistic world, we say, okay, now I want to watch my mind. Oh, good, I'm in the right cinema. I'm inside my head. Oh, yes, there are images. Oh, yeah. And so it's locked us into a little tiny space about the size of a football. You know. And that's how big your mind is. Because that's what you think it is. You think it's, you know, my mind's inside my skull. And you're reinforcing that by closing your eyes. Oh, yeah, they're my image. They're my emotions. There's images. Oh, yeah, there's that, there's that. As if you just walked into a darkened theater and closed the door. You know. That's reinforcing a superstition. Not useful. Because the space of the mind is vast. Absolutely vast. And to think that it's somehow behind your eyelids, and the eyelids are a screen on which images are being projected. Really superstition. So that's kind of a deeper issue. And a pragmatic issue, having the eyes open, for many people, does tend to bring greater clarity. Not for everybody, obviously, now you're an exception, but it tends to bring a bit more brightness to the awareness. And many people found also that by having the eyes even a little bit open, it tends to get you grounded in the present moment more, so that the mind is not so easily carried away by thoughts about the past and so forth and so on. It tends to be a bit more grounded in the present moment, something like that. There are more subtle reasons than that, but those are two. Okay. Now, having said that, I remember His Holiness Dalai Lama was asked this once, and you know, and what the response was: let your eyes be open at the beginning, but as you're going into samadhi, as your mind is really getting collected, really focused, going into kind of a samadhi, then he said, if your eyes should gradually just start closing down, don't try to jerk them back up again. Yeah, just let them be. Let them be. So don't make a big deal of it. And then Namgyel Nobu Rinpoche, in his book on dream yoga, yeah, I think he makes a very, very, he makes many useful suggestions. I think this is one of them. So we'll have a little sneak preview of lucid dreaming and dream yoga. Very, very brief. And that is, there's a variety of methods for falling asleep in the practice of dream yoga to induce lucid dreaming. And some of these entail elaborate, really intricate visualization, like in the throat chakra. Even to do them at all when you're wide awake would be a challenge. To do them as you're falling asleep, that would be a challenge, really a challenge. So he knows that. And I've tried it. You know. And you just stay awake. And then for me, just, you know, the amount of effort needed to sustain the visualization just... And so what he suggests, and I think is really good advice, is number one, get really mellow. He didn't say that, but that really is a prerequisite. Get real mellow, real soft, real relaxed. And then lay your head down on the pillow. The sleeping lying posture is preferable. And then as you're falling asleep, settle your mind in its natural state. Do the practice we did this morning. Settle the mind in its natural state. And he didn't say keep your eyes open, because nobody's expecting you to fall asleep, unless you're a horse, you know, with your eyes open. And so then you can let your eyes close. And so that means he's given permission to practice settling the mind in its natural state with eyes closed. Okay. Good. We'll get to this written question tomorrow. But I think that should do it for now. So, falling asleep is a really good idea. And if you fall asleep easily, some people can like fall asleep within 5 minutes. You know, the head hits a pillow and boom, 5 minutes later they're gone. If you're one of those people, then I would strongly encourage you to try settling the mind in its natural state as you fall asleep. It might really augment your ability for lucid dreaming. It would be very, very helpful. Some people find it's more like 20 minutes, a half an hour from the time they lay their head on the pillow before they're actually asleep. Mind a bit more agitated, turbulent, energetic, bright, whatever. Not so easy to fall asleep. Wind people, vata people, tend to have a harder time falling asleep. Earth people. What's it called? Pitta. Kapha people. Earth people. I tend to find it pretty easy to fall asleep. So if you find it more difficult to fall asleep, then I would suggest the infirmary, full body awareness, mindfulness of breathing. As a nice segue. And then when you're getting a bit drowsy, then stop practicing shamatha and just allow yourself to fall asleep. So you have homework now. Falling asleep homework. Okay? So enjoy, get a good night's sleep. See you tomorrow morning.